privilege to have Kirsty Rennie, who's an epidemiologist, the epidemiologist, an epidemiologist at Unilever, and epidemiologist at Unilever Corporate Research. Kirsten did her first degree in biological anthropology in Cambridge. That's when I was in Cambridge, and she was an undergraduate when I was in my first teaching post there. Since then, she went on to do a PhD in epidemiology at the Institute of Public Health with Nick Wareham. She worked on energy expenditure and physical activity. She knows an awful lot about physical activity patterns. Was central to probably the biggest study on physical activity patterns in the UK. Am I right?
The
one with Nick Wareham.
The ethic.
Okay. Okay, what have you done? Worked as a research fellow at the University College, London, Medical Research Council, Human Nutrition Research in Cambridge and the University of Ulster. Her work, I'm just reading it, is physical activity, dietary behaviour in relation to preventing metabolic risk factors for obesity in adults and children, assessment of diet and physical activity in population studies. She's a research fellow at Watson College in Cambridge in epidemiology, and is in Unilever Corporate Research. It's intriguing for me to know what epidemiologists do in Unilever. Please.
It certainly was for me as well when I first joined, so 2 years ago they recruited myself and a colleague into Unilever Corporate Research as the first two epidemiologists to try and look at the way epidemiology could play a role within Unilever. So what I'm going to do is just give you a very brief overview of Unilever Corporate Research, and please ask me questions at the end more about Unilever. And then I'm going to go on to my area, which is lifestyle epidemiology, and given the interest here, talk about some of the potential lifestyle factors that may be associated with obesity and the limitations of the evidence that we currently have, and then how we can use in the future, in particular, lifestyle epidemiology to give insights more into obesity prevention. So corporate research bioscience is where I work, and it all started, the sense of public health, if you like, comes all the way back to one of the founders, W.H. Lever, who in 1890 was quite a bit like the Cadbury and Bourneville, very public health minded, which is unusual for the time. He wanted to lessen the work for women and make life more enjoyable and rewarding, both for the people who use the products, but also he set up a model town for his workers. And Unilever's grown a lot from that point. It's now an Anglo-Dutch company with around 200,000 employees, which is a global company, and working in both developed and developing countries. So we've got quite a strong presence in countries like India and Indonesia. But I think one of the main draws for me was the bottom point, which is, and I believe it's now 160 or 170 million times every day, consumers come across a Unilever product. So it's a great opportunity, if you're thinking about public health or making changes, to do that through the products that Unilever have. And Unilever's split between foods, some of those may look familiar to you, and what we call home and personal care, so things like your washing powders, but also your Pond's, Dove, Rexona and Axe, which I think is known, got links in the UK. So they've got quite a big portfolio, and they do things like corporate social responsibility already. You may have heard of the Dove Self-Esteem Fund, where they also provide funding to try and get teenage girls more physically active. They do work with OMO in clean water supplies in countries like India, and work closely with UNICEF and WHO. So the work, if you like, of Lever continues to this day. And in 2004, they set up a mission that all Unilever products would lead to this vitality to life, which was helping people feel good, look good, and get more out of life. And very central to that is health and getting people to maintain their health throughout the lifespan. So from early childhood all the way through to old age. And that's really where we sit in terms of corporate research and health, is how can we help the business think of ways in which they can do that. So we sort of sit as a bit of a think tank up in Bedford, working towards helping Unilever think for the future. So for example, next week I'm going across to talk to some of the people within the business of what kind of things we should be thinking about for 2020, for example. And that's one of the ways epidemiology can feed in. The head of Corporate Research Bioscience has this vision of having that we, which is a very ambitious vision, but we can see how public health feeds into this. Wouldn't it be great if we could get rid of absence of disease, disability, so that everyone had a really good quality of life for 100 years? Given that the difference between lifespan between countries is largely due to the environment and not genetic reasons. And so together with Martin Green, they put together where we are positioned, where Unilever Corporate Biosciences position, is if you think of pharmaceutical industry, they sit up here, they think about the high-risk group, people with high cholesterol, have diabetes, and develop drugs to work on that sector of the population. However, for companies like Unilever and Public Health, we're actually more concerned with the majority of the people who sit down here. And one of the things that we particularly are interested in is what makes these people down here stay healthy? Because if we understand the top 10% of healthy of the population that are healthy, this might give us insights into how we can help these people get back to this healthy area down here. So we don't really work up here in complete disease states. We're more concerned with the population as a whole. So if you know anything about epidemiology, you can see why they were thinking of how epidemiology can help. It's just to demonstrate that we spend a lot of time on planes because we collaborate right across the globe. Working with, this is not just epidemiology, but working across bioscience, we work across, for example, with Framingham Heart Studies in Boston. Across Europe, we've got a project over in China, a population-based study. And so we're really looking at cross-cultural comparisons and how these things also can be applied in developing countries. So for those of you who are not so familiar with epidemiology, the standard definition is it's the study of distribution and determinants of disease or health status in a population, and looking at the occurrences and causes of the health effects of humans, which I usually get down to who gets ill, why, where, what. This is the simplest way of putting it. And there's been, between 1950 and 1980, what we call the golden era of epidemiology, the sorts of things you probably have heard about. With the original studies in the 50s identifying that it wasn't pollution in the cities, it was actually cigarette smoking that caused lung cancer, how radiation may be linked to cancer, and then some particular ones that viruses could actually be in the causal chain for some cancers, and things in my own area, things like the role of dietary fat in cardiovascular disease. But we're sort of, these big findings, of course, are happening less and less as epidemiology goes on. And some people have argued, well, is there actually a role for epidemiology anymore? Because we've made so many of these big discoveries. Which is really where I think epidemiology is moving, although a section of, is thinking about lifestyle epidemiology, which is where I sit, which is how we can look at lifestyle-related factors, physical activity, diet, sleep time, smoking, etc., and its impact on health and disease, such as obesity, diabetes, and cardiovascular disease. I don't think I need to tell this audience about the problem with obesity and the fact that now it's essentially taking over the problem of underweight, and with many countries facing the double whammy of dealing with underweight and communicable disease, and all the issues of the diseases associated with obesity at the same time. I think it's really good to keep remembering that nearly 80% of chronic disease, like coronary heart disease, diabetes, are happening in developing countries, because sometimes we become very centric to North America and Europe, and this is something we keep hammering as well to the business, that the chronic disease is happening in places like India and China. And I'm always struck, I've been working in childhood obesity, when we were working on the obesity task force document, that the childhood obesity is becoming a major problem, but it's got quite a different distribution to the adult obesity. So some countries where they don't have so much adult obesity actually have a very high childhood obesity, which is saving up big problems for them in the future. And we know, because it's happened so dramatically, this is just figures from the UK, if you look, the difference between 93 and 2002, pretty much in every age group you've seen an increase in obesity. Most worryingly, I think, in the middle age group we're seeing an increase, and now much more in the younger age group. So we do know that though genetics play a part in predisposing some people more than others to developing obesity and obesity-related disease, it's essentially the environment that we're looking in. And so if it's the environment and its behaviours, we've got to look at what behaviours we can use. And this is the typical curve we always use in epidemiology, is how can we shift the population in a behaviour downwards, or upwards if it's a positive behaviour, to get the obesity and the BMI curve, if you like, further down. Well, a lot of factors have been put forward, and I just use the WHO list here of the risk and protective environmental factors that have been put forward. So the WHO arranged the evidence to convincing, probable, possible, and not so possible, but I've just stopped there. With the green here being something that's maybe a protective environmental factor, and the black something that is a risk factor. So you can see here that for convincing evidence, being physically active, consuming high amount of dietary fat is protective, being sedentary and high intake of energy dense foods is considered to be risk factors for obesity. Now, this was put together in 2003, and it looks like it's quite clear cut, but unfortunately, as with all these things, it's not quite as clear cut as we would like. What we've found in the last 15 years is, particularly in epidemiology, is people look at their cohorts, look at the data they have, and try to relate a particular factor to the risk of obesity. So to look at people who consume, for example, a lot of soft sugar-sweetened beverages, and look at who gets fat and who doesn't over the next 5 years. And it's extremely difficult to work out which aspect of the diet may be important. Where can we actually intervene? For example, energy-dense diets have been put forward as one of the main causes of a positive energy balance, that is consuming too much energy. And when we talk about energy-dense diets, we're talking about a diet that's high in fat, has a low water content, is high in sugar, and has little fruit and vegetables. So I've just taken some slides from Barbara Rolls in the States that where she illustrates here quite nicely. For 110 calories, you can consume that many raisins or that many grapes. And the difference being that grapes are much heavier because they have all the water still in them. And you'll feel much fuller if you consume all those grapes compared to raisins. Similarly, partly because of this high fibre and higher water content of fruits and vegetables, if you compare these two meals, exactly the same calorie content, but you can see that this one has many more vegetables in it, and so it bulks it out. So for the same amount of calories, you're consuming a lot of grams of food, and that will fill you up, because we tend to react to the bulk of food rather than the calorie content. You don't tend to say, oh, I've had 300 calories, I'm going to stop eating now. It's because you feel full that you tend to stop. Now, if you remember, WHO said it's convincing that energy-dense diets are linked to obesity in terms of a high energy-dense diet. But when you actually look at the data from epidemiological studies in the literature, you actually find that you get as many studies that find a null association as you do those that find a positive association. So even though WHO in 2003 says it's convincing, people are still arguing over the role of energy density. I think we're all familiar with, especially when you walk into a petrol station or convenience store, you can get your king-size Mars bar, 25% bigger packets of crisps, and it seems quite obvious to us that ever-increasing portion sizes also would be linked to increased risk of obesity. And what I've done here is take a chocolate, the different sizes of chocolate bar, crisps and cola, and mapped it onto the energy needs of a 9-year-old child. So if a child consumed this king-size chocolate bar, she's consuming between 20 and 25%, so up to a quarter of her energy needs in that one for the day in that one food item. So if she consumed, which if you think about some children, it's quite easy to do, a king-size chocolate bar, the larger portion of crisps and a large cola, she's pretty much got all her energy needs in those three snack items in for the day. So she could, if her energy, she could stop. Of course, they're low in nutrients, but she could stop in terms of energy.
Can you tell me what a large cola is?
It's those. I'd have to look back at the data I used, but it's one of the those size ones.
What's 600 mils?
600 mils.
So I'm collecting a couple of bottles, that's all.
Oh, right.
Globally, they're very enormous.
They do, yeah.
Yeah.
With the American ones in particular.
Yeah. British ones. And in India now, they have an American sized one as well as a normal sized one. So,
yeah, same in Thailand, yeah. So the WHO said portion sizes could be a possible risk factor for obesity. But again, if you look in the literature, you find as many studies saying that they do find an association to those that don't. And snacking, it all seems to us, well, that we know that the culture's changed dramatically. People don't have three meals a day and sit down as a family, but people eat more and more on the go. And the WHO says insufficient evidence about snacking. And again, if you look at the studies, there is as many who say there is an association as there aren't. So from that you say, well, what is causing obesity? They all seem the obvious factors. Is it real that these factors aren't associated with obesity? Or is it the limitations of the research approaches that we're currently using? So all these debates and editorials and the journals saying, oh, it could be causing, it could not be causing. Is that real? Or is it due to the differences in populations? Or is it due to how we look at the research? Well, if we first of all take the energy-dense diets, which, if you remember it, the WHO said was convincing, and the evidence says it's equivocal. What I've got here is some data we've currently got in press, which is taken from a group of children where we did 7-day weight diaries with them. That the parents did them very well. And we did very precise measures of their energy expenditure and very precise measures of their body fat when they were children and when they were adolescents. We know that they did really well in all the measurements in terms of the accuracy. So confident in the data, and And what we looked at here was if we combine the energy density of the diet, which is the amount of calories they consumed divided by the amount of grams they consumed, we looked at that in relation to how much fat they gained, their body fat gain. There was no association between the energy density of their overall diet, when we looked at all the food and drinks they consumed, with body fat. However, when we looked at foods only and took drinks out, we found that there was an association. So that those people who gained the most body fat between childhood and adolescence were those that had a much higher energy density of their diet for the foods only. Now you'll find, if you looked in the literature, as Tracy has done, is that there are as many studies that use this approach as use this approach. And there is no agreement currently in the literature of how we should look at energy density of the diet. So that could be one of the reasons why we spend our time debating whether energy density is responsible or not, because we're all taking different approaches. So what we would recommend is that people publish all the different approaches until people decide which one is the one we should all be using. But it does make it more complex when you're trying to work out what's the causal factor. And without forgetting the good old misreporting, it's often in papers, if you think about portion size, snacking, all these things, and if any of you have ever done, measured your own dietary intake for a few days, it's quite common to see misreporting of energy intake, and it's much more common and higher in people who are overweight and obese. So if you think about it in terms of percentage of energy needs, lean men and women would underestimate around 20% of their energy needs, so around a fifth of their energy needs. When you get to people who are obese, they're underestimating, or misreporting, I should say, around a third of their energy needs. So if you think about that in when we're trying to look at associations between obesity and what someone's eaten, that could be one of the reasons. And it's not just limited to people who are overweight or obese, but also people who are sort of, if you like, known dieters. So people who have reported dieting recently are more likely to, in both people who are of healthy weight and overweight, be underreporting their energy needs much higher than those people who are not on the diet or have been on the diet. And young people are no exception. Though it's very low in 4 to 6 year old age group, you can see that as children get older and if they're overweight, they're much more likely to be underreporting their energy intake. And we just completed a study in 14 to 17 year olds, and I can tell you, underreporting is awful. So they really, and that was against doubly labelled water, so we've got high accuracy in knowing their energy expenditure, and they were underreporting a lot. But when I say underreporting, what I should be saying is, we use the term misreporting, because what we don't know is, are people, when they're recording what they eat, omitting certain foods, omitting that chocolate bar they had mid-afternoon? Are they underreporting specific foods because they consider them to be unhealthy and they don't want to write those ones down, but still write down the apple and the banana? Or are they under-eating during the dietary record? And if you've ever completed a dietary record and kept one, you know it's actually sometimes you think, oh, if I try and write all that down, it might be easier just not to eat it. And also, it's actually the known behaviour technique that works for people who are trying to lose weight, is to keep a record. It's a great way of cutting down the amount you consume, so we know that for a fact. And though we can quantify how much they're misreporting their total energy intake, we don't know what foods they're misreporting or not reporting. If you get someone to do a 20... Yeah?
I just interrupted. Haven't people been observed in their reporting? I mean, surely if there's such a consistent this reporting, observation should be the...
It's quite difficult, though, to do observation in a large enough group. Some people who have done it, like at the Dunn Nutrition Centre, have shown that, snack foods tend to be the ones that are underreported, and foods high in fat. But a lot of the evidence comes from studies where they've done 24-hour urine collections, because then you know how much from that you can determine protein consumption. But we don't have a good biomarker as yet for differentiating between fat and carbohydrate. Sheila Bingham in Cambridge is be working on one for sugar. So from 24-hour urine, you could determine how much sugar someone has consumed and protein, but we're still not able to get down to the fat carbohydrate and specific foods. The problem is, as soon as you watch someone, they change their behaviour. So it is a problem. But in big studies, doing 24-hour urine isn't really a possibility. So it's limited to small studies to try and tease out what foods might be misreported. And of course, that's going to vary as well between cultures and populations. So when you come to things like portion size and snacking, that could be one of the main reasons why we don't find associations with obesity, because of the scale of underreporting that is actually there. And not that many studies do try to quantify the level of underreporting in their dietary data. You might find a one line in the discussion where they say, this may be because of underreporting. But there are ways that you can at least estimate the effect of misreporting and get a feel for the scale of it in your study. And back to physical activity, which is one of my pet projects and where I started, is why should we try to be more precise to measure physical activity? It was what we started at in 97-98 was we know physical activity has great benefits and lots of health outcomes, but to actually do recommendations and to see which aspect of physical activity is the most important, we need to be able to measure it a little bit better than has been done in the past. So in the 80s and 90s, you may find in studies people said, are you very physically active compared to your peers? In this America, there were lots of questionnaires, how many blocks do you walk a day? But if we're trying to make cross-cultural comparisons and compare someone who lives in rural China with urban China with the UK, questionnaires don't tease out people's physical activity levels. If you don't go to the gym and you don't have a very physically active occupation, it's quite difficult for if I asked how many miles do you walk a day? If someone's doing housework and is running after a little child, they can't quantify how much physical activity they're doing. And so in the last 10 years, and certainly the last 5 years, there's been a development in using objective measures of physical activity to try and tease some of these factors out. And also to measure the effects of interventions. So I spend a lot of time talking to people who want to do interventions on physical activity to measure the effect of an intervention on obesity and health outcomes. Because if you tell someone to be more physically active, then go back to them and say, so how much physical activity have you been doing? Of course they're going to say they've been doing more. And so we need good measures, objective measures, to actually look at their physical activity levels. And this is an example of one, which is a triaxial accelerometer. This boy's wearing on his hip there. And it gives us minute-by-minute movement counts throughout the day. And what's great about this is we don't just look at the total activity, but we can see the peaks and when he's being very active and when he's not. This particular boy, this is his Saturday, so he didn't get up till 12:30. And he's a manic skateboarder. So all of this is him skateboarding throughout the day. But if you looked at beyond 7 o'clock, you can see he watched TV and he was on the computer and he didn't do very much. Whereas during the day, on the Saturday, he was very active. And it's being able to break this down, together with questionnaires to know that it was skateboarding, that we start getting a handle on people's physical activity levels. So that's, if you like, the risk factors and things, just to give you some examples of, you need to be quite accurate in how you measure diet, physical activity and other factors. But another problem is the outcome, which is how you measure how fat someone actually is. I think you're all familiar with BMI, aren't you? So this is some data from our study in China from DEXA scans. So we've got the amount of fat they have and the amount of fat-free mass. And the population split between those people who are in urban, in this case this is data from Shanghai, and those people who live in a rural area outside of Shanghai. This is how much fat-free mass they have in kilos divided by the their height squared, and this is the amount of fat mass they have, again kilos divided by their height squared, and that's to remove the effect of the body's their height. And what you can see here is the great variation in both men and women. We do see a difference between urban and rural, but also just the large spread in terms of, for a given amount of lean tissue, bone and muscle, how much variation in the amount of fat they have. And similarly, for a given amount of fat, the difference in their muscle and bone. So when you look at something like body mass index, you're missing, if you like, all that variability. And in fact, this is the same data, but just with some lines drawn on. If we just take this top one, which is men, and this line here represents a BMI of 24, which in a Chinese population is considered to be the cutoff for overweight. And you can see for that level of BMI, there's a big variation in the amount of fat that they actually have on their bodies. And when we've looked in young children, so this is lean children, none of these were overweight or obese, but we looked at those who had obese parents and those who had lean parents. What you can see is the difference in the BMI and the body fat underestimates actually this large difference. So if you had an obese parent, you had a third more fat tissue than if you had lean parents. And this is in 5 to 8 year old children who, if you looked at them, you would not consider them overweight or obese. In the interest,
what do you attribute that to?
It's the way you do the measurements. So the problem with the body fat is you're putting it overweight, so disguising the difference. And also the height differential that you do see. Even at age 5, you see that children of obese parents are a bit taller.
Okay, and this is using centiles for body mass index, or for the kids?
No, it's just based on the parental obesity.
Oh, okay, sorry.
Yeah. And this is using deuterium dilution to do lean and fat mass. In the interest of time, I'm going to skip through this, but use an example that if you don't adjust for the differences in tissue between people, you can get some lovely erroneous results, as we showed here. So I sat down with my data and I got, we've got 100 children wearing heart rate monitors for a week, and we also measured their energy expenditure using doubly labelled water. And we looked at the amount of time they spend doing sedentary and light activities, and their activity and energy expenditure during that time. And we found a lovely significant result that the more time you spent sedentary, the higher your activity energy expenditure. It's a little different to what we were expecting to find. But of course, even as I was just saying there, actually, is that an obese child actually has a little more muscle and more bone, on average, than a lean child, to support the extra fat mass that they're carrying around, and because they're a bit taller. So when you adjust their energy expenditure, because they're, of course, expending more energy because they've got more muscle in them, for the amount of fat mass that they have, the fat-free mass, so the amount of muscle and bone they have, there's no association at all. So what we're probably seeing here, and I say probably because we can't totally rule it out, is that these people up here, maybe the people with the higher muscle and bone, because they're a bit heavier, so they expend more energy in activity, and hence why we get this association. So we always, this is back to, when you want to relate something like diet or physical activity to obesity, it's only as good as your measure of body fat and how you're actually measuring body fat. If you're measuring body mass index, or you're measuring fat more precisely, even skin folds, you might get different answers. And you really have to think about body size and composition, body composition, when you're looking at results, rather than just think, oh, well, that's their energy expenditure. Because people, a child who's on a growth curve for being obese is going to be taller and have more lean and bone. I'm going to speed up a little here just to say that, so what I hope I've illustrated as well, you can't look at everything in isolation. And this is where I think we're really moving. It's rather than just saying, okay, let's look at fruit and vegetables in relation to obesity, we're now starting to think of a much bigger picture. And this is really what we're trying to do in corporate research, is think about how all these factors interplay. There's a lot of research going on in sleep at the moment and how sleep could impact on obesity, how stress could impact on all these things. And we can't just look at one and pick one out in isolation. We have to look at them together. And randomised control trials may not be the answer. Everyone's always said, oh, everything, test it in a randomised control trial. But it's very difficult to do that. It's very difficult to people get change someone's behaviour and make them keep it. Unfortunately, we can't randomise people to be binge drinkers and non-binge drinkers, or smoking and non-smoking. And given what we really now know about obesity in terms of socioeconomic and ethnic groups, culture specific, we'd have to do huge randomised control trials to look at the effects in all those groups. And we have to think about the interactions. If I change one aspect of someone's diet, they'll probably change something else as well. So if you change how much they drink, they'll change other aspects of their lifestyle. And we can't then look at any interactions between all these different lifestyles very easily in randomised control trials. I think most people would be familiar with this, which is the Obesity Foresight System Map. Lovely complex diagram. I'm not going to go into it at all, but other than to say, there's a huge amount of interactions going on there between social, cultural, economic, all sorts of factors. And so whereas people have very much said, oh, role of the food industry, what really the role of the food industry is to think about how their part in it plays and how it interacts with all the other factors. So, for example, you've got here smoking cessation, peer pressure, and things like that. As is essentially what we're saying to, it's a global issue for Unilever that they need to address, how they can impact on the environment. If you think back to one of my first slides, the 150 million products seen every day, how can that impact change that big diagram? How can they impact on this abnormal environment? So in conclusion, I'd say we can't just take one risk factor in isolation, which is what in the past I think a lot of people have been doing, because when they do that, you often find no association at all on that perhaps food item on obesity risk. Lifestyles are complex things. What we eat is linked to what we do in terms of sleep, many other behaviours we do, physical activity. And if we really want to dig down on those complex interactions, we need much better measurement instruments. We need good measures of physical activity, good measures of those things. And I think now there's a real realisation that we can't just look at these factors without thinking of the broader socio-economic factors and environmental, the economics, the built environment. As Franz is always saying, why tell a woman living in an inner city area that if she ate a few more pieces of broccoli that she'd reduce her risk of cancer, when her immediate problem is feeding her child and dealing with the day-to-day day-to-day stresses of living in her environment. We can't just take things in isolation. And we need much better modelling techniques to deal with this, because, of course, your culture, your built environment, play directly on all your lifestyle. So you can't just throw them all in into a multiple regression model. We need to think about that in much more detail. I'm not going to go through this, but other than to say, I think epidemiology has still a big role to play in obesity and putting all these things together. But we have to remember that epidemiology doesn't give you the lovely golden answer. It's only as good as the study design and measurement you use, and it deals with on a population base, not individuals. So we can't predict if one individual will become obese or get coronary heart disease, but we can think about populations. It's good for generating hypotheses, but it doesn't necessarily give you a nice, clear-cut answer. And I think that's nicely summed up by John here, that it's about how we can draw useful information from the data.
Okay.